I would ask for a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I would ask for a motion for the approval of the minutes of February 10th.
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
We have several lengthy information items this morning, and I would like to get started. The first is the blue-yellow line service realignment, the transition to Dulles.
Yes, Richard? And obviously this is a major service realignment that we're preparing for in the future, and I have Tom Harrington here, who's been coordinating the effort, along with Barbara Richardson, to talk about what this involves, the plans as we look forward over the next year, year and a half, and how we would communicate it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom.
Good morning. The purpose of today's presentation is to give an overview of the blue-yellow line service realignment and discuss communication strategies, implementation tasks, schedule, and budget. We were last here at the board in July of 2010, and in particular, the board had asked for more information on communication, how we'd communicate with customers, and then what the implementation steps would be, and that's the subject of today's presentation. In the presentation in July, we talked about the blue-yellow realignment and said that it would serve three main purposes, the first being the need to address peak period crowding and service reliability, particularly on the Orange Line through Roslyn. Second being realigning service to better match the changing ridership markets. And the third being it's a necessary step in the transition to the future Dulles rail extension. So I'll go through these three points. On the first, addressing peak period crowding, what's shown on the chart is our average loads from April through December 2010. We measure load in terms of passengers per car, and the actual official standard is 120 passengers per car. We typically have planned, though, for about 100 persons per car as being what we consider acceptable conditions. And one thing to keep in mind is that's an average over the whole hour. Customers often will experience trips that have much higher loads, particularly if there are any service disruptions. So as you can see, the orange line in that period exceeded the 100 persons per car. Okay, next. In this chart, we're showing a growth in ridership between 2004 and 2009. We've drawn a line basically from the traditional downtown, K Street corridor, from the eastern side of downtown. And what you see when you look at numbers is that the western half of downtown, while generally having more jobs, the growth in ridership was much lower. It was only 3% between 2004 and 2009. Eastern side of the downtown had 17% growth in that period. And basically it's saying we're trying to realign service to provide more service to that growing eastern part of downtown. Okay, next slide. As I mentioned, the blue-yellow realignment is a necessary step towards transition to Dulles. And the timeline generally for the Dulles extension is that we're talking about next year, FY12, blue-yellow realignment. FY14 is the scheduled opening of phase one of the Dulles extension to Wheelie Avenue in Reston. And then in FY17, or calendar year 2016, is the planned phase two opening to Loudoun County, the end of line is the Route 772 station. When the Dulles extension opens, we will have essentially three lines passing through Roslyn. So we have the current orange line, the current blue line, but then also the new Dulles line. Our operating constraints at our portals is 26 trains per hour in any one direction. And so in balancing the loads of those, a realignment of the blue line is something that's been planned for a long time. It was part of all of the planning for Dulles. And what we're basically doing here is looking to move towards that operating configuration. And then the other part of it, the last bullet on there, was just that currently Roslyn does operate at that maximum throughput. L'Enfant doesn't yet. And so one of the other reasons to the blue-yellow realignment is basically to maximize throughput across the river. And so that's another benefit of this alignment. Okay, next slide. Let me just explain the blue-yellow realignment for those who are not familiar with it. Basically, starting with, say, Franconia-Springfield, what the realignment will do is shift one-third of the Blue Line trains, make them become Yellow Line trains, in a sense, in effect, from Franconia Springfield all the way up to Greenbelt. And that's one-third are basically three trains an hour that become Yellow Line trains. And then what we are able to do then is add three trains per hour on the Orange Line between West Falls Church and Largo. And that gives us the added capacity, and it also ensures that we have the same levels of service going out to Largo. So we've circled on the map basically areas that have the sort of new color services potentially serving them. And as shown there, the rest of the presentation we're going to discuss is gearing up towards a June 2012 proposed start date, and that's shown there on the chart. Let me talk a little bit about benefits. First of all, it's capacity, and as you see, it touches pretty much all lines except the red line. The yellow and green lines benefit from the three additional trains that go basically across the river from Pentagon all the way up to Greenbelt. The orange line benefits from the additional three trains from West Falls Church over to Largo. The blue line is the area where, particularly the link between Pentagon and Roslyn, we would be cutting back three trains. So as we look at the loads, and based on what's out there today, this does have the effect of bringing all the lines under the 100 per car that we were targeting by rebalancing loads. Second area of benefits is time savings. As I said, it touches most of the a large portion of the system, and here we've calculated that about 40% of the peak period trips would have some benefit. These are not huge time savings. Rather, these are changes of a minute here, half a minute there, but it touches a lot of riders, and so thus, as we've sort of summed up the time savings, it ends up being over 900 hours in a typical AM peak period of time savings. And I think I've already talked about the areas that are seeing that increased service. Okay, next slide. On potential impacts, it's a smaller portion of the peak period trips that are affected, about 6% of the peak period. The time increases, though, are potentially greater. And certainly, the way to look at it is anyone that needs to go between Pentagon and Roslyn, where that is clearly the shortest path, would experience some increase in time. So by taking out every third train, there's the potential that you'll have, whereas the blue line typically leaves every 6 minutes from Franconia Springfield, one of those will become a yellow line, and so if you're waiting for that train, it could be potentially up to 12 minutes. You'd have to wait for the next blue line train. So it's an increase of 6 minutes over what's out there today for those types of trips. A key fact here, issue, assumption that we're looking at is the shifting of blue line trips. In other words, we're shifting the service. We fully hope that riders shift along with the service. If no one shifts, obviously we'd have very crowded blue line trains by removing some of the cars. If everyone shifted, we'd have the same level of loads. We're basically looking at about a 20% shift as being what we expect to happen, and which is shown in those loads that I looked at before. So one thing we'll want to make sure is that customers realize that they can take advantage of the increased service and save time by making the change. We also focused a little bit on L'Enfant Plaza Station. One impact of it is that by having more folks cross the river who may be going to the Metro Center, Farragut, West, McPherson Square area, it's going to increase transfers at L'Enfant Plaza Station. For people coming from the yellow-blue, crossing the river, they'll transfer at L'Enfant to get on the orange and blue line. L'Enfant Plaza Station does have the sufficient vertical capacity. It is one of the stations that was built to handle transfers, and so we have looked at the loads in that station as well. So the net benefits, when we looked at the positives and negatives, was that it's a net time saving system-wide when we looked at the time changes.
I had a question.
No.
The 20% to 30% or 33% shift is based on what? Was that based on experience, past years, or is this just a guess? Or
the 20%, which is what we're kind of targeting, we really went sort of station pair by station pair and looked at the before and after times. And a lot of it comes down to sort of arrival rates. When you come to the platform, obviously, if you want to take the blue to Farragut West, you're there, and a train's up on the PID sign, it's coming in a few minutes, it makes sense to wait for that train. But if, say, you just missed a blue line train, and when you look at the PID, you'll see yellow, 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 time-wise, it's better to get on the first train that comes, go across the river, and transfer at Lomfon. So we looked at those sorts of possible trips, and from that, found that basically a roughly 20% of people that it would make the most sense to make the shift. Okay, at this point, I think Barbara's going to go into the communications aspects of the plan.
Okay, so this is a very dramatic change for us, and certainly getting ready for Dulles and the bringing on the Dulles service is the first major service change for Metro since the original design of the 106 miles and the layout of the initial map. So it's really important how we do it, how we explain it to customers, and the tactics that we use. And it's important that our customers understand that a change is occurring initially when we decide to change, but in the long term, for people who come to the system for the first time, that they understand what the service offering is. So the plan objectives are to make sure that we're enhancing this, that this is a good experience for our current riders, and certainly attractive for newcomers, that we take advantage of proven successes. We looked at how others have done major service changes, that we educate customers and can clearly communicate the benefits in customer language. What is it for me? How does this relate to my travel? And that we create a sense of ownership about it and that enthusiasm, particularly among our employees who are our ambassadors to our customers. And to that end, we did do a lot of research. We interviewed many people internally, some of you, board members. We spoke to the JCC, the RAC, the ACC. We've conducted an online survey. We conducted focus groups. And the first bit of information that I'd like to start with is a review of the best practices. Next slide. To gather insight on how others changed, we looked at a couple of systems, Los Angeles, and the tactics and the tools they use for extension of the Gold Line. They use a website for primary information. They rely on Twitter to keep customers updated. They offer an opportunity for people to sign up for particular accounts to get regular updates of what is happening. In Chicago, as they were looking at extensions, they also used the website. Their residents could submit questions directly to the CTA and get a response back. And I personally spoke to folks at in New York at the MTA about, in particular, about the map development and the map design. And the key there that we found is that they put it in the hands of professional map designers. Simplification was the key to remove clutter from the map, make it very simple for people to understand, and that one of the interesting takeaways for me was that iterations of the map, if you will, locations of parking facilities, bicycle connections, bus connections, are located on their website. That's where they put that information. So, the research goals were to find out about how our own customers communicate or what the information that they want from us and when they want it from us, and the distribution points that we can reach them. We also tested messages and different tools, again, learning what they prefer. We came to understand that this will be an iterative process where we may start out with particular messaging. We may learn that something is resonating with one group, and we may have to change it as we go along, as we explain things. But mostly importantly is what I said before, is it has to be from the customer's perspective. To that end, we conducted an online survey, 2,300 people, frequent, regular, and occasional riders responded. And from that, we were able to plot, next slide, our customer journey, if you will. And this is a valuable tool for us, not just on this initiative, but really should form a map, if you will, for communications for us and the tools and tactics that we should use going forward. The big takeaway, and there's part two of the journey, as you see, we only get down to the platform here. But the big takeaway here is that, and some of this may seem very common sense for us, even as we think about ourselves as riders, but that people are constantly reconfirming their trip. That they, from the beginning of finding out, and we learned that many people, especially occasional riders, will look to the website to first determine their trip. Our frequent riders will look toward apps. More and more applications, smartphones applications are being developed. The map is, in the travel process, is a starting point, certainly, and it and a point of reconfirming, validating that they're heading in the right direction. Our frontline staff provide us what I view as an opportunity, because most folks do not use them in their travel planning and for help. The frequent riders less so, and occasionally some of our new riders or probably tourists and so on will ask for help. But I think that this is an area that is ripe for opportunity to create ambassadors. They look for signs to directing them at the right, that they're going to the right train. So the directional signs that we have in the stations are very key for almost all audiences, as you will see. And the PID system is important, as they're standing at the platform knowing that the right train is at the platform for them. They, despite what we hear about the announcements that they're not, you know, that people don't pay attention to them, they in fact said that they do. And that is one of the big cue points for them, is the station announcement, train announcements. This is pretty basic and elementary. It's something that I do myself, but they look out the window to make sure. And I think it's, you know, as commuters in particular are reading the paper or multitasking and trying to do work before they get there, all of a sudden you find out, oh, you know, I either missed it or I better get off.
Yeah, Cola?
Yeah, could you go back to the previous chart, please,
sure,
for a second? Where did you say you got the percentages in, from survey data or projection?
Yeah, from online survey data.
And how, what kind of response did you get? I mean, what are we talking about percentage-wise?
2,300 respondents.
Okay. You know, it just seems high in some of the areas. And then
well,
what's the station agent?
I should also say it could be high in areas related to technology-dependent communication, because these are folks that took the survey online.
Okay.
You know, they self-selected
yeah.
online. So they are more, you know, they're more anxious about that. So.
And what is a station agent?
The station,
I haven't heard that terminology before, agent.
In the kiosk, the station
you mean
staff,
the station manager?
Manager, correct.
Okay, station manager.
Yeah.
Okay, I was thinking maybe you were going to put out other people there to give directions and instructions, that's all.
No.
All right, okay.
Since we're back to that, I wanted to ask that one, because that was the big thing that came out of this for me. You interviewed station managers?
No, we did not interview station managers.
Okay.
This the information that you're looking at in relationship to the station manager or agent, as I call them, is frequent riders, 6% say they will look for help from the station manager, only 6%. Regulars, only 11%. And occasional riders, probably about a third, will go and seek help. I think it's an opportunity.
Okay. Well, since you stopped here, I hope you don't mind.
No, that'd be my guess.
And in concluding from this data, are we going to say that station managers' information is part of this as well?
Yes.
And I'd like to hear how you're going to get there.
Mm-hmm. Or you have a training component planned.
Mr. Chairman, Barbara, can you tell us the difference between frequent riders and regular riders?
Uh-huh. Frequent riders are those who take Metro Rail 8 times a week or more. Regulars are 1 to 7. And occasional people are maybe 1 or 2 a month.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Go on.
Keep
going. So announcements are important. We're on the train. The equipment is important. And, you know, Dave and I, keeping this in mind during the 7000 series design process, how trains are marked on the outside, the front of the train, trip verification on the inside of the train, The pylons, as you can see, are probably, you know, making sure that we're at the right platform to get the right train are important to most everyone, and signage inside the train. So a couple things here that I think are important is that signage is critical, the equipment is critical, and signaling change through announcements and posters and such in the stations are important. But the final thing that I want to mention is that all along the way, the key for many people is the destination of the train. That's what they're looking for. They know that they're on the right train by the final destination of that train, so they're looking for that always. So implications, website will be important to us. We need to communicate with our customers when they want to hear the information, when it's meaningful for them at the platform is key. We should take advantage of digital tools, more advantage of that. Our station managers have a role to play. And to make all of this stand out, we will be looking to brand this effort so that it stands out and apart from some of the changes that we normally do for track outages and so on. Next slide. So the research findings, messages, we need to focus on rider benefits, make the improvements, some of the things that Tom talked about very clearly in customer language, and what do riders need to do with it. Those were the things that we also tested in terms of messaging, and I won't go over the specific messaging. Next slide. So the map. The map is an iconic symbol for Metro, and for many, many people, it is Metro. And it is the strongest brand statement that we have. And so what we learned, we conducted a series of focus groups, four focus groups. They were small because we were not going into the focus groups so much to test the final design of a map as much as concepts to help us go the next step. We went through probably 11 different concepts of maps, tried various things. We were looking at what's the easiest and simplest way to tell travelers how to navigate in with these changes, and you know, how do you lay that out? How do you demonstrate rush hour service versus regular service? How do you demonstrate when you've got you're mixing up colors of lines, if you will. So we were testing all of that. We found out that people and our customers have a very strong connection to the map. They want to keep it very simple. They just, you know, they value the simplicity of it. The colors are a big connection for them. And just in the focus group work, and it's symbolic, people identify themselves to the Metro system by the color of the line. So that's not a surprise because we probably all do that. I'm a red line person. And so, you know, there's a loyalty and a connection that way. The destination points are critical. They really are the pathfinder for people. New colors. To them, we got a negative reaction when we tested colors that were new, where we put a new line on running through the system that was not other than the dullest line, but they viewed it as overcomplicating it, making it confusing. So we had to be very careful about that. Interestingly, they were open to new styling. The map lines, we've always had a thick line on the map from the beginning that the original designer designed. So they're open to a little bit of styling by that, but not much, you know, kind of thinning down the lines, if you will. And they really thought that changes in the map and this change overall really signals to them positive changes at Metro, that there are positive things happening. So, again, these were preferences that were stated, so I don't, you know, we need to get to another level where we finalize some design options and test further, but I would not. But I would just say that the updated styling was, they were open to that. And this is just a concept. This is not the final. That the extensions, if you extend it as we have here, if you extend lines, as you see at the orange going out to Largo, if you extend the line, it created less anxiety about you were overcomplicating it.
Mr. Chair, when you're finished, I'm sorry, Peter. Go ahead and finish.
Okay. That it was reassuring to them, and if we do go this way, that the communications part, how when the changes happen, will be even more important, that we'll have to really communicate heavily. Other colors, moving yellow to blue and moving other colors on other lines, was acceptable and preferable to introducing actually brand new colors. They very much like the five primary colors on the map. Rush hour, they like to see rush hour somehow depicted in a consistent way. What does rush hour mean consistently across all the lines? And if we depicted it, they thought that it should run all the way through. Icons such as clocks and numbers, we tested those. They thought those were extraneous, not necessary, caused more clutter. Dulles is viewed as acceptable for a new color. It is new construction. From a customer standpoint, it's a brand new line, so it should be such. And we've previously had it depicted in a hashed way, and they thought that it was also okay to do it kind of in an open line way, you know, not shaded in. So. And there was other information that we received. So what we're going to do at this point is take all of this information and all of this feedback and bring back the original map designer, Lance Wyman, who designed the map at the beginning and laid out all 106 miles of it even before the system was built out. We have retained him, and he is going to start work with us on actually laying out, taking all of this information, because some of the information is also conflicting, and sometimes you get information that you put it on the map and you say that doesn't necessarily work. So he's very pleased to be coming, he will come back, help us design it, but not only will we'll be doing a couple of more refinements to it, and also he will help develop involvement, customer involvement and feedback on it. And then third, we are asking him to develop guidelines and principles for map changes going forward, because there are none. We do not have any written guidelines for future changes. And if Metro is going to expand again in the future, once this is finished, we need to have some rules about how we depict that on our map.
Barbara, could I recognize Mr. Benjamin?
Ms. Richardson, thank you. That research was extremely valuable and very thoughtful and very well organized. I really like the approach you're going through. And I am reminded of a time when we, in fact, tried to do something very similar. Dick Page tried to do it with the orange and blue lines, with shifting which line was going to end where on which train in order to balance loads. And because of exactly the issues that you're talking about, people became so confused and so upset that they didn't make the change, or they started with the changes and then stopped and didn't make the changes in the end, because people didn't know where they were going and they couldn't accept that. I think the principles that you come up with are very important ones, and probably the most important one in my mind is particularly people who aren't very familiar with the system don't identify with a line. Yeah, I'm also a Red Line user and I would really feel bad if you changed the color of my line. That would not be good. But somebody that's new goes to the station manager or somebody else and says, I'm going to such and such a place, and the answer is, get on any train in that direction that's a blue line train or an orange line train or a red line train or a green line. They do that by the color. I believe the principle, and one of the few principles that actually exists, is I don't think there's any way that you can get on a line and end up, unless you're going in the wrong direction, end up somewhere other than where you intended. In other words, the line color tells you where you're going to go. And you pointed out that the destination is the thing that everybody's really nervous about. Now, I understand primary colors are really nice, and coming up with new colors are really difficult, but I think we need to work through, and maybe broader than focus groups, because focus groups tend to be a somewhat limited set, that whole issue of if what really, really matters to me is my destination. And understanding that when you have three or four or five colors next to one another, that's not simple. Having some way for people to know that destination, other than having to look at a sign on the train and say, did I get on the right blue line train, really becomes very, very important. And it's harder to fix afterwards than before, and that's why I like the way you're going about this and the way you're thinking this through. So think very seriously about the fact that the color tells me that if I get on this train, it's going to go somewhere past my station, or if it stops short, I can get on another train and keep going. But I'm not going to have to go back and change lines.
Yeah, so how we signal the destination more prominently, I think, is in looking for opportunities to do that.
And something other than signs on the trains. And
yes.
To that extent, you may want to reconsider other than primary colors or things like that, and try that out on people, because the really difficult thing for those people who are not used to the system, or for those of us who get up early in the morning and are a little bit bleary and get onto a train and don't look carefully and end up in the wrong place, that can be something of a disaster. That destination is the really important thing, as you pointed out.
Yes.
Mr. McKay?
Yeah, actually kind of related to that, I'm wondering, since when you get on at Franconia, Springfield, or Van Dorn, you really only have one chance. You have one choice. You know, you don't even pay attention to the train. You just get on one when it comes in because there's only one. And those two stations in particular, I'm worried about how I didn't hear anything specific station-based communications. And this is communication system-wide that we talked about. But what in specific stations are we going to do more where people are most impacted that's out of the normal list of things that you mentioned?
I haven't got to the tactics yet, but for stations, when we're going to do signage in the station, we're looking at platform, something different at platform. We are going to train our station managers. We want to do a training program for managers about this change that's coming. We also, when the change happens, you know how we deploy management people, we call them MIPS internally. We're planning to do something similar to that initially, too, to help commuters in particular when that happens. So those are some of the things that we're thinking of.
I do think that that's going to be one of the most difficult things at those stations, because people are programmed to not pay attention to what train they're getting on. It really doesn't matter what color it is at that point, because they're just going to get on whatever train comes in. So it's really important at those stations at the beginning of the lines in particular, where the highest percentage of people are getting on in the morning, that they know what they're getting on. And related to that, if the trains are coming in into the station and folks are coming out to those, out to Franconia, Springfield, or out to Van Dorn, if I'm going to get on at Pentagon City and head out to Van Dorn or Franconia, and I'm one of those customers who looks at the signs in the front of the train, or I'm one of the ones that just looks at the color on the side, what will the lettering show? How am I going to know if it's a yellow line that's going to Huntington, or a yellow line that's going to Franconia, Springfield, if I'm only looking at the color? And then also, what would you write on the side of the train? Would you write the final destination? So it would say yellow line to Franconia, Springfield.
Destination.
Okay. And I've got a number of questions of Tom operational that I can go back to at the end. We can finish this part.
Mr. Downing?
Following up on that, I think this is a case where on-train announcements will be critical. So in that zone where you've gotten on the train, they should hear at least three times before they get to the point of no return that this train is going to. And the other thing, I think, destination is important, but my view is at least some midpoint is important as well. That, you know, if you told me this train is going to Largo or this train is going to New Carrollton, I'm not going to either of those. But I sort of would like to know, is it going to go to the places that I want to go to? Is it going to go through Metro Center? Is it going to go through L'Enfant Plaza? Yeah. Yeah, I would know it for its Ms. Hudgens. Okay. Ms. Hines.
My question really is about, is it your plan, I couldn't tell for sure in your conversation, that the map will in some way show that the Dulles line is joining? Because the cost to do these maps is tremendous,
yes,
and the gap is not particularly long.
Yes.
So, yes, it will. And this is being new. Does it show then those trains continuing through the system so they become, some of them go to Largo, some of them go to New Carrollton?
The Dulles line?
Yeah.
Yes.
What happens?
The Dulles line, from the customer perspective, from just the focus group work, and I need to stress, focus groups are for preference, indicated that people want to see the Dulles line all the way through the map.
Okay, and so part of what we would be doing, I mean, in one sense, there's, and I don't know about load, but there's a solution to the orange line thing by showing that one of them is the Dulles line and the other one is the orange line. So that you don't have, because I share this concern about how people are going to figure out that they're actually on the right train, going to the right place. So if the purple line, or I'm saying, the Dulles line, sorry, wrong, I know, I'm a mistake. It's the secondary color that's missing from the point of view of people who do that. But if that line comes all the way through and some of them go one place and some of the other, then you don't have a confusion on the orange line about destination. And then the other thing, and this, I guess, is more operational than the map, but, I can definitely take this offline. As I read this, what I thought the riders in Arlington were going to experience is 2 years of happiness, yes, on the orange line, or 3 years, because we're going to get these extra trains. And then Dulles is going to come in, and our happiness is going to go away, because those trains are going to, which were just coming from Vienna, are now going to be coming out from Ruston, and we're going to be back to potentially lots of crowding.
Well, this took us
so am I misunderstanding that?
I mean, this takes us up to 12, and we need to build out after that. But do you want to answer the operational question?
Ms. Hewitt, did you have a...
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a bit of a transition. I think we talked about some of the trains, West Falls to Largo. We also run some service from West Falls today. When Phase 1 opens, a lot of those trains will shift to Wheelie Avenue. We have looked at loads. We have looked at forecasts for Dulles. We think we can maintain loads because we are also going to be ramping up as we progress with some longer trains and so forth. But I think you are correct that you'll see certainly a short-term big gain. We're putting out a lot of capacity. That as Dulles comes online, definitely you'll see some increased passenger loads.
And Mr. Downs, if I might just ask one additional question before you move. The other big issue in Arlington is the Pentagon to Roslyn piece. I haven't heard anybody talk. My understanding is there was agreement about some level of increased bus service. It's a fiscal year away. But I don't want to leave this conversation without understanding whether that's something we're coming back to, or whether that's something, to what extent Arlington has to put that in our budget versus it being in Metro's budget.
We have looked at the bus service, and we will engage with Arlington.
Thank you. We have looked at the bus service. I think one challenge is going to be it becomes very costly to run at more frequent service, say, than the rail, particularly in the blue-yellow realignment where it's only every third train that gets diverted. Running 12-minute bus service or even more frequent than that would be fairly costly. But we certainly have looked at it. We have a plan that we can talk to Arlington about to see whether that's something that we should pursue further.
I think as this conversation continues, we're going to continue to hear that from the neighborhoods that are most affected by this change in Arlington.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
First of all, thank you, Ms. Richardson and Mr. Harrington, for your very, very detailed report. I think, as Mr. Benjamin said, this is very, very beneficial information. But I do want to echo the sentiments of Ms. Hines about that Orange Line fork. That's right there in Prince George's County. It's troubling to me, and I want to ensure that we don't have the confusion that I envision from that. And it's my line. It's actually where one leads to where I would go from home, and the other leads to where my law office is. So it's both of the lines are both of those destinations are where my points of origin. And I just see the tremendous potential for confusion there. And I know that's what Ms. Hines was expressing, but I want to make sure that we're really, really clear and we have a real way to avoid that. I just see that being problematic.
Can I just say something about that? And there's more in the presentation. As everyone's pointed out, communication is going to be extraordinarily important here. And I will tell you that I experienced a little bit of this blue-yellow line when we shut down Foggy Bottom for that weekend. And I rode the system a number of times that day. And it was due to our employees on the trains and the station managers making excellent announcements, because the added trains that we were running, the specials, had no destination sign on them. So you could get on, like I get on at Pentagon City, and you didn't quite know where the special train was going, okay? But the announcements that were made consistently, before you got on the train, when you got on the train, even after the train left the station, because you still had another opportunity to straighten your destination out when you got to Pentagon, were extraordinary. And it made all the difference in the world. And yes, people were standing on the platform a little bit confused. But after the repetition of the announcements, and really clear announcements by our employees, it sorted out by the time they got to Pentagon. So you really didn't see people making the wrong choice and saying, after we left Pentagon, oh my God, I went in the wrong direction. But so communication is going to be extraordinarily important. And how we lay that out, and it's not only the verbal communication on the trains, but all the signs and everything else. And that's why we're taking our time here to really go through this in a very methodical method. And I agree with you on the maps. No matter which version I've looked at, it's not easy. But it also reflects the fact our system is becoming more complex in its operation. So it's going to be a challenge, and that's what we're trying to rise up to.
If I could just say, we can't put everything on the map. You can't lay the burden of the communication on the map. The burden of the communication needs to support the map. But having said that, I appreciate, you know, the heads up on these different points, because we will watch for them. But when the change is occurring and how we're telling people if they're going in the right direction, we have to help them through the system do that.
If I may, first of all, thank you for your response, and you too, Mr. Sarles. I think that communication is key, and I have to take a moment to say that every time I ride the train now, the rail, the communication has gotten to me over the years better and better. There, we used to have the sound system. You couldn't always hear it before. You couldn't always hear where you were, and that was particularly, it was bad for everybody, particularly for those who are sight impaired. But now I know it's really, really clear. Now I see it's much, much better, and it's consistently better, too. It's not just here and there. It's consistently better, and particularly when you get to one of the, you know, the hubs where, you know, they're announcing, you know, where you can catch it. Like if you're on the red line, you can catch the orange and blue line, or vice versa. And even this morning, they were announcing, you know, that, okay, there was a train. They were keeping you informed. There was a train ahead of us, so they were letting us know that. That was a small delay. And then when the train got packed, they let us know that, hey, there's a train right behind us, so, you know, everybody doesn't have to cram on this one. There's one right behind us. So the information has become much, much, much better, and I'm very thankful that I would be remiss if I didn't give kudos in that department.
Thank you. Mr. Downing?
Yeah, I, again, want to thank you for this. Having sort of a fact-based discussion is pretty useful. One of the facts that I see, going back to your customer journey, is when you add up the numbers, everybody uses multiple ways. It's not any one is the single way. Everybody must be using at least three or four to get numbers like this. So consistency of the message among all those will be critical.
Yeah, actually, if you go to the next slide, because the points that we just discussed were just made, which is the map is not the vehicle to understand the change. The map is the wayfinder, that the website will be critical and essential for us. And the communications, as Mr. Downey says, has to be multisensory for everybody, and particularly for those that are customers who need a little, who need a different avenue to communicate, the accessibility community. So it needs to, you need to be able to hear it, you need to be able to see it. We need to have all those cues. And it needs to stand out and look different. And to that end, we will be branding it a particular. We will be calling it something. So the strategy, briefly, you can go through this, but we have different strategies for different audiences. As we talk, the benefits must stand out for our customers. We have to give them information at the right time when it makes a difference to them. So the brand identity, signage, announcements, e-alerts, social media, the ad campaign will all be important. Members of the media are important to us in conveying and communicating the information. Metro needs to be the primary source of information of the change, and it will be important that we create a timeline so there is a cadence of milestones that's reported so that everyone is tracking right along with us. So a news pipeline is important, and we will need to have designated spokespeople in charge of delivering the message. On next slide, for the customer community and business leaders, we will need to get out and talk to different advisory boards in the jurisdictions and the councils. And we can also reach out to some new groups that we have not worked with previously, transportation management associations and the like. So we want to identify them, attend and create materials and create a database and an email, I mean, just a really basic email database of all these contacts to give people information as we move along. And as I said earlier, employees are very important. They are our ambassadors, and we need to encourage best practices, those that are helpful, and reinforce the role that they play in the success of this. We're going to put together a training program and prepare them and provide them with a calendar and update them as it is. When we have major changes, we provide them information in a pretty thorough way, but with this one, we'll need to continually do that over periodic time. So there's more detail on tactics in the back of the appendix.
Ms. Hines?
Ms. Richardson, two quick questions. What's going on in languages other than English, if anything?
We typically try to do Spanish. We also do other languages. We try to print materials. If you come in the building, you'll see the timetables, the bus timetables are in multiple languages. But we're also going to work with our civil rights office to help guide us with this, too.
We have, as you might imagine, in Arlington, we have a number of groups, language groups that are prevalent. For instance, there's a very large Mongolian-speaking community in Roslyn. That's our second language after Spanish. So if you would like to yes. figure out how to talk to those folks, we would be happy to help with that.
Yes. Okay.
And then the last question I have really is, we, as I mentioned, there are three significant neighborhoods that are clustered around the Pentagon City, Pentagon area.
for whom this may be, you know, one of the major changes besides rebuilding Crystal City. And we do have contacts there, and it would seem to me that it might be useful to be able to, for you to talk directly to them. And then overall, do you want Civic Federation and those kinds of contacts?
Yes.
So we'll just
come to you and your offices, and
we'll just make sure that you get that
jurisdiction.
We're going to get affected both directions.
Ms. Sargent.
Thank you. I want to thank staff for the presentation, and the general manager said this is complex. But usually when you do something complex, you're trying to do a lot. And that is what we're doing, and I think it's really welcome. Ms. Hines, I'm going to be excited forever, and that's really important. I raised the question of station manager, and each time you said training. And I hope you didn't only mean training, because you gathered a lot of input, and the people that know an awful lot about what customers think are those station managers where they come to the door. And my past experiences is when something has happened and I go down and I ask the station manager and they say, well, you know, I don't know. That's the way you talk to us. So I hope that you will see that as an input piece, because I think they can give you info that is relative to the things that confuse the customers, and that can be very helpful. The other part about the map, I'm thinking of it today as a static map, and I'm thinking of it in the future as an active map, that is, as you move forward. So when you are setting up these principles, that it will transition for us as we have more technology available and all kinds of things, so that we are not just limited to that drawing as a static document to us, and that we will make use of that. And then just the last part, the importance of trying to find the vehicles of broad communication with the diverse communities that we serve, and I think that will really enhance it. And I think leading with communication is really the key for acceptance and understanding of change. So I really think it's a good job.
Mr. McKay.
Thank you. I probably have a number of questions for Tom, but just to clarify, we're only talking about peak time, this change, right? So non-peak, nothing will change from the way the system operates now.
Correct.
Okay, because that's a piece of the communication that needs to be out there, too. Another question on the change in capacity chart, where you have minus 30% Pentagon to Roslyn blue line.
Yeah.
I assume that logistically there's no way to reduce that number simply. In other words, capacity is, you know, really a measure of time in between trains. And so, for example, if you ran an 8-car train through there every third car, something of that nature, you wouldn't be projecting that you could reduce that 30% impact number any lower.
No, that's a good point. The 30% is if they remain as the current mix of 6 and 8. And I think one of the aspects of the plan we do want to look at is, can we put more 8-car trains out on the blue, particularly as we see what's happening with passenger shifts, to make sure we keep the loads under control.
I think that's an important piece of this.
And you're right.
I have heard from a few folks who are concerned about that 30% reduction number, and any effort that can be made to draw that down either even before the launch or to be able to quickly respond to it after the launch, I think is important. And then lastly, the projected or the expectation that 20 to 33% of the current blue line riders will shift to the yellow line. I know that's a stab, a number that we think is plausible. How are we going to measure that number? What are we going to determine as a successful number? And if we're not achieving those numbers, how would we, if this isn't working, what thought has been given to how you might unwind this? And obviously we would hope it does work, but I think we also have to be aware of, you know, what plans are being made if the consequences are different and it doesn't work. And is that 20 to 33% number now the goal? Or how are we going to determine success?
I think those are great points. First of all, we clearly want to measure what happens. As you said, we have a pretty good idea, at least who would benefit from it, whether passengers will actually do what you know, it sort of looks like would be the rational choice. We're not sure. And the one thing people really value is the one-seat ride that they get today on the Blue Line. So even though they may save time by transferring, the hassle of getting out of the train and going into a crowded transfer station is something that you have to take into account. So we're going to try to do a survey, measure beforehand, and then we'll look at after. I think that's one good thing about doing this prior to the Dulles Extension opening is we'll get some actual data on how people react to a change like this, and maybe we can react better to it when the full Dulles Extension opens and there's even more of a change. So that's one thing we want to do. I think the other aspect of it is 20% looks likely. We actually can influence that with marketing and with some of the stuff Barbara talked about. We know if we look at the numbers, okay, if you're going to that station, this is the right way to go. But do the customers know that they could save a little time? And we have to be sure to use marketing as a way to achieve that target.
I think it's going to be important before this happens for the board to have a really clear number of, you know, what makes this work. Because if you start getting under 20%, then the benefits to some of the passengers might be greatly reduced, and of course there's some give and take there, but I think we need to know before we do this what would be success. And then my last point is, as a yellow and blue line frequent rider, I have a choice at the end of the line whether to get on at Huntington, which is a longer drive for me, or whether to get on a lot closer to my house on the blue line. And I go to the yellow line, so I don't have to switch. So I think one of the things we're going to have to look at is how many people have switched entirely the first station that they're going to get onto the system, and how do those numbers, you know, get factored in? Mm-hmm. Because people have choices out in southeastern Fairfax and in Prince William County. Those folks who are coming up and getting on the blue or yellow line, they're not that far apart geographically, traffic-wise, and there are some people who will drive a little bit further so they don't have to transfer, and I don't know what's going to happen with those, but we have ways to measure the number of passengers coming into those two stations after this happens and to see whether or not people's starting point is entirely different, which, of course, can skew the success number here because we may not know, you know, if they changed entirely what station they're starting at. They may not fit into these numbers in a neat way. So we need to be conscious of that because a lot of passengers are doing that now. They're deciding which station to start at based on whether or not they have to switch.
We are proposing to do a rail passenger survey in 2012 that would be prior to this service change. And so we can design it in a way perhaps that then we could do a follow-up smaller survey that would look at the after effects. But one thing we clearly ask people is, you know, where do you live? Where do you park? How did you get to the station? So we can track what happens with the origin station.
Any other questions? Barbara, I want to make a point that you didn't cover, and that is the deadline for jurisdictions to submit station name changes.
Yes, well,
it's in the packet. But it's a hard deadline, as I understand it. It is the 1st of August. Given the printing schedule, given the logistics of this, everybody needs to have any suggested name change from the jurisdiction in before that date. And that I'd also suggest that there be some rough guidance from Metro about what is an appropriate amount to be included instead of it being the yellow pages for the stop, that there is a clarity that you mentioned about simplicity and accessibility that might be appropriate guidance that could help jurisdictions manage part of this process. Ms. Hudgens?
And we are speaking of name changes to stations that will go through phase one and two. Mm-hmm. I think that needs to be in.
There is a policy. What I will do is I will provide it. Tom and I will provide it to you for advance reading. We will come back and talk to you about it, I believe, in May. And then we'll make some recommendations as well. But there is a policy in place.
This is just advance notice about the deadline.
Yeah.
Can I ask, in terms of that information, can you give it to us before May? You said you were going to get us that information out as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We can send to you right away for, just for reading background, the policy, and then allow us a little time to put together some talking points. But I think it's not very long. It's about 3 pages. I think you could take a look at it. We will also attach a list of the current station names.
Mr. Downey?
Where it says jurisdictions will submit, what does that mean? What is
it's
formal action by a governmental body, or?
The jurisdictions submit station names to you,
okay.
The board,
so
for approval.
From. Thank you.
It's part of the policy. But, again, I'll provide you with copies of the policy.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? If hearing none, thank you for a detailed presentation. Next, we have vital signs.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Today I'm here to present on the March Vital Signs Report, which is covering the most recently available information on performance for most measures through January, with the exception of 3 customer injuries, crime, and arrests, and citations, of which we're talking about December data. Next slide, please. Looking at the high-level executive summary for our performance for that time period, Metro bus on-time performance has steadily increased for 4 straight months from October to January. The service operations managers on the street have continued to strengthen our ability to promptly address service challenges aided by IT applications that allow for real-time monitoring. Bus fleet reliability improved in January, outperforming the new target of 7,400 miles by 17%, and that's due in part to regularly scheduled preventive maintenance and better performing hybrid buses that are becoming a larger portion of the fleet. The on-time performance for rail in January represented a stop to the recent 3-month downward trend. That's positive news. On-time performance improved on the blue, orange, green, and yellow lines, with the largest improvements on the green line, which performed at 90.2% adherence to weekday headways. These improvements occurred despite a 14% decrease in rail fleet reliability from December for the 2000 and 3000 series rail cars and the 5000 series. Metro Access fell below its target of 92% in January at 90.2% on time performance, and this was due in large part to the ice and snowstorm on January 26th and 27th that severely impacted road conditions throughout its service area. Escalator availability increased in January by a small 0.2%, which equals about 1 unit, as a result of less unscheduled maintenance hours and faster repair times, which is the mean time to repair. Escalator availability gains were dampened by an increase in planned outages for modernization and overhaul projects. Elevator availability stayed consistent with December performance despite a 10% increase in out-of-service hours related to power outages. In terms of passenger injuries, they declined in December, and that contributed to the lowest rate of passenger injuries this fiscal year. On the other side, employee injuries exceeded the FY10 injury rate for employees for the first time this fiscal year, due to an increase in straining and slips and falls. And if we look at what contributed to that increase, 60% of it came from bus and rail transportation, with the remainder coming from our plant maintenance function, the police, and bus maintenance. And in terms of slips and falls, as you know, we have more icy conditions in the winter months, so part of that was due to that. The accommodation rate increased significantly in January. So while the icy and snow conditions have a detrimental impact on some of our performance, customers appreciate the bus operator's handling of treacherous conditions, and they call in and express their appreciation in terms of, and that impacts that performance measure in a positive way. looking forward to future performance action highlights. We will be, launching an aggressive 2011 track overhaul project to restore the rail system to a state of good repair. Work will require single tracking or station closures during 7 weekends, as you're aware. We are completing the replacement of the Southeastern Bus Garage, now known as Shepherd Parkway Bus Facility, by summer of 2012. That'll eliminate overcrowding at other bus facilities. Metro Access will be communicating its upcoming fare changes with customers and assisting with travel planning for the transition. We will improve escalator performance through a number of actions, including increasing preventive maintenance compliance to proactively identify maintenance issues. And I believe following this presentation, there's some more detail on our escalator program plan. And the Department of Safety has started to release new lessons learned flyers that describe safety issues that have arisen in not only Metro system but other systems and how we can learn from those. Okay. I also wanted to point out, if you haven't noticed, the new performance display in the lobby. As you walk in to the right, we've added that to improve accountability and transparency. And it includes our mission and 5 strategic goals, how our measures progress towards 2 strategic goals, safety and delivering quality service, the data trends and an explanation for performance changes. We also have to the right real-time bus and rail arrival information for folks leaving the building and service interruptions along the bottom. Finally, I wanted to talk about the target for bus fleet reliability, which is measured by bus mean distance between failures. We changed the reliability target from the prior 6,700 miles between failures to now increased it to 7,400 miles between mean distance between failures. The target was revised using a statistical analysis of the 2010 calendar year data and reflects our rehab schedule, the obviously, as you're aware, acquisition of our new hybrid buses, projected revenue and non-revenue miles, seasonal impacts, some uncertainty related to the new technology, and fleet composition. And finally, moving to next steps, we will continue to evaluate targets for other vital signs measures, as we've talked to you before about. We have revised the employee safety measure, and that will start to show up in future vital signs reports. And in terms of employee injuries, that's to be more consistent with OSHA reporting. In terms of passenger injuries, to be consistent with the National Transit Database reporting. And finally, at the next committee meeting, we'll be talking about the benefits and limitations of benchmarking. Sure. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Giancola.
Yes, on rail fleet reliability, I'm reading the report and I'm sensing that we're, with the large number of 2,000 and 3,000 series cars and the 5,000 series rail car problems, are the 1,000 series cars more reliable than those 2 series of cars? And these are the ones obviously we're required to replace and we'll be replacing. I mean, are we seeing better reliability in the 1,000 series cars than particularly the 5,000 series cars?
Yes.
The one thing that is hurting these numbers is that whenever we were able to run these consistent like configurations, these fleets behaved much better. Now, since we have to do this mixture of bellying rail cars, especially the 1,000 series in the middle, that is having a definite technical and performance impact. The 5,000 series, we do have some initiatives on power supplies and other exchanges of equipment that will help bring these numbers up that we've identified. On the 2,000-3,000 series, we've got 2 major efforts around those fleets, which is doors and also air supply systems. We're upgrading units, replacing and rebaselining, which we feel that will help improve this performance dramatically.
What are the ages of the series cars? How long have we had the 5,000 series and then the 2 and 3,000 series?
I believe they were delivered here first part of two in the 2000 timeframe, 2000-2001.
For both 2, 3, and 5?
No, the 2 and the 3 are original, the original equipment. They've been through a midlife overhaul.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, comment. Do I remember that the mixing of the fleet was not an NTSB recommendation? That the mixing of the fleet was acknowledged to not have any real safety impact? It addressed an immediate concern about the perceived safety of the 1000 series on crush?
It was not an NTSB recommendation. It was a policy decision that was made. However, it's a decision I am sticking with after reviewing that with our people and outside experts. I feel it's still the preferable way to go.
Okay. One other question. Are we stuck forever with the problems of the junk that is actually the 5000 series cars? Are we going to see this for as long as we have them in the fleet? And with the impacts that they have when they run in mixed service about pulling trains out, are there any conceivable solutions for repairing this junk?
Yes, sir. On the 5000 series, one of the things that we've started doing is we're really not working with the car builder anymore. We're working directly with the primary suppliers that provided this equipment to resolve these issues. We are out there, for example, addressing propulsion issues with the supplier, the brake issues we seem to have a pretty good handle on, but there are low voltage or high voltage controls and systems that we're having to address working with the vendors. Some of these vendors, their primary center of excellence is not here in the United States. So there's a lot of interaction in Europe and other parts of the world. And whenever you don't have the resources here stateside to really address these major systems, there's a lot of extra engineering or approaches for us to address these areas. And I would just add, for example, like on the 2-3K when we talked about the air supply system, we worked with the vendors for years. We're at a point now towards it's more cost-effective for us to replace it in kind with something brand new that has a warranty that is 21st century and it's service-proven, and so that's what we're doing.
Ms. Hines?
On the issue of rail on-time performance, you did last month you showed us a great sort of take-apart on the escalators where you looked at planned and unplanned. And it struck me on on-time performance that we have controlled and uncontrolled things that are in play here because we're doing a lot of work and we're shutting down areas and stuff. And I just wondered if at some later point you might come back and take that apart for us so that we could understand what part of the on-time performance we're causing purposefully as opposed to stuff we don't expect, like arcing wires or those other kinds of things. So that's a request going forward. And in your presentation on the benefits and limitations of benchmarking, I was hopeful that next time when you come with that, there's jurisdictional measures. It's either page 69 or page 21 of our packet. Some of these around operating costs per passenger trip and fare box recovery ratio and all, I assume operating costs per revenue mile, that those are things that transit agencies track all over the place in the country. If there's any comparable other systems that we compare ourselves to, I'd be interested in understanding how our numbers stack up to their numbers, recognizing that every place is different, and I'm sure we'll hear about that from you as a result.
Yeah, I would second the idea of benchmarking, but suggest we have to do it with considerable caution. If you saw my correspondence back and forth about administrative costs, and it depends how you look at them. as long as we look at them consistently for what we do and consistently for what others do, we can learn something.
And sometimes the challenge on that is to get the other comparable systems to reveal their information to us so we can talk about what those perhaps limitations are or that it's not apples to apples.
Any other comments? I want to thank the GM CEO for the performance indicator board outside. And maybe a suggestion as we make this permanent here that at some point think about extending that kind of specific performance to bus garages and the rail yards about how everybody is doing and how they're doing about performance. I think it helps people understand the role that they play in the system. Hearing none, we'll move to the next item. Thank you.
Thank you.
Escalator program.
Good morning. At our last meeting, we were asked to provide a little bit more detail on how we selected our maintenance and locations and also trying to tie this into the very extensive report that we provided y'all with a lot of graphs and details. Again, this was just another quick overview of our overall status of the equipment, 588 escalators, gives you the date range of that. And again, it's very key to note, 443 of them are over 25 years of age. As of March 3rd, there are 25 scheduled escalators out for service. Reason why we put that in there, that is just a hard number that will be out all of the time. And as we progress and get more aggressive with our capital improvement program, you will see those numbers, you know, increase. And that does impact our overall availability. We do not cut that number out. It is something that the customer sees, and again, that's the standard at which we're going to maintain. Next slide, please. Okay, on this right in here, basically, for the overall capital improvement program, there's just a varied methodology on the way that you really select these things. But based on what we're really up against, our field is often narrowed. I mean, whenever you have four of your seven suppliers that no longer exist, some of them are not even in this country anymore, it makes it, you know, pretty easy on what you have to prioritize. Basically, some of the things that we did set in motion, for example, it's well publicized at our work at Foggy Bottom. We set that contract well before the VTX report. As you know, these things are deployed that take a lot longer. The VTX report, though, is very, very helpful to help us during this process as we transition not only on our capital, but what we really need to focus on in other areas of the system. As well, DuPont Circle South, both of these which are areas that have high volume, high issues. This is another one of these contracts, another one of these areas that was already planned well in advance. Just to kind of give some support on the last presentation that we did with the bubble chart, you know, seven of the 14 areas were in there were kind of like our availability at our top 20 ridership stations. And, again, that's what we're trying to work at is the stations that we know that have the heaviest duty cycle. Then you factor in the equipment age, the availability, the vendor support, the technology that is out there, that's what kind of helps steer us in that general direction on what we need to work on and address. We are monitoring, for example, the other systems or the other units, and this is the last bullet, is just to kind of give you an idea, is that we see other areas, even though they might not be in a top 20, their technology and equipment is a low performer. So what we're looking at is this is how we start scheduling our short-term and our intermediate as well as our long-term efforts on this, trying to work with data as well as the other variables that we work with on a day-to-day basis. Next slide, please. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Benjamin.
I remember sitting in a presentation a number of years ago where almost the same words were said about replacing escalators, that because we had some escalators that were really, really in bad shape, we had no choice but to actually replace the escalator as opposed to rebuild or rehab. we're doing it again. When we did it last time, the next presentation I think we got about a year or two later said those were the worst performing escalators we had, the new ones that were put in. How are we making sure that we aren't going to make the same mistake again?
I can tell you, first of all, it gets into the statement of work and how we're specking out the equipment from day one. That's been the biggest focus. Whenever you look at equipment that is specced out, that uses technology towards the end of its cycle life, you're going to have problems or issues. Also, the way that we set up these solicitations, the lowest cost is not always your best interest. With that right there, you need technical or best value over the life cycle of that asset. Again, I can't comment on what they did in the future. I can only comment on what we're facing and the direction which we're going forward. And I do know that the equipment and the systems that we're putting into place now are much more robust than what we previously see.
And are they ones that have operated in similar heavy-duty environments where we can look and see?
We are looking at industrial applications, not, no pun intended, not a very stale mall environment where, you know, it's a little bit more cordial.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, again, we've talked about escalators on several occasions over the last few months, but it would be helpful to me to get some feedback from you, Mr. Kubitschek, about the definitional things related to rehabilitation, overhaul, and replacement, and maybe even a footnote in some of these reports about not only what how you define them, but also what's the useful life after you complete a rehab and overhaul, and obviously replacement is just a total replacement. I know we do this in other transportation areas, whether it's pavements or bridge maintenance and such, so I'm just kind of curious to have you talk to that, but also eventually have some sort of footnote so we have that reminder all the time.
Absolutely. Part of the request also by the board previously was what is the industry doing and what is the average age? And so we've worked with our consultant as well. We've reached out to different transit authorities, you know, across the United States, you know, BART, Chicago. You know, we're part of the APTA consortium as well. And so I have a draft report that we're putting together that I think is going to answer some of those questions, because some of the information that I got back, at least when you're reading it from a draft perspective, was very interesting. And I think whenever that's assembled, part of that will frame that. And as far as what is considered an overhaul or what is considered, you know, a total replacement, we can definitely footnote that out to give you a very clear and concise path of what those efforts undertake.
You want to give me a quick summary?
Quick summary.
What rehab, overhaul?
Okay. Basically, rehab, a lot of times it's basically taking the unit down. It's keeping all the superstructure in place, but it's replacing a lot of the vital components and stuff in kind. A lot of times it's not, if there's a technology upgrade that can be applied to the system, it generally is. But more than likely, it really addresses in kind. An overhaul type of application most of the time really applies to the drive units. They're kind of like in between the major replacement or major rehab cycles. For example, you got drive units or drive chains. Those things are only designed to last for a certain period of time frame. If you do not stay on top of those and those things fail, then generally when their failures occur, they're more costly and very catastrophic.
Useful life, how long is if you do a rehab on a typical
system?
3 years?
Useful life for rehab, from the industry perspective, it really varies. Since we have so many, everybody kind of looks at us as the leader.
A range,
I've seen the range where they look for you to do a rehab every 3 to 6 years. And then from a total replacement, that ranges, if you talk with the OEMs or the original equipment manufacturers, they say, you know, 20 years. But most of the people that we talk with, they have their equipment far longer than that.
So and overhaul would be in between the rehab and the...
Yes, it would fit in between that as well.
10 to 12 years, 15 years?
pretty much like a midlife. You would just try to cut it in half. Okay. On the maintenance side, you know, again, it's basically what is our main thing that we can do to reduce the, you know, the outages on a regular basis. So for those wondering where that picture's at, that's Navy Yard. That we'll be facing that here very shortly, again, with the baseball season. Also, increasing a parts availability. That's the key right there as well. We're ramping up our materials to make sure that these things are staged in place, and there will be a cost impact on that a little bit. Not anything out of the ordinary, but it's something that as we look at this, we do expect to see our parts usage go forward, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in my presentation as I go forward. Okay, increase in preventative maintenance compliance goal. At the last report that we gave y'all, we showed y'all where we were at. We were at there at 40%. We went back and looked at the information. There's no way realistic that I could tell you in good faith that I could take it from 40 to 90 or 100 in 6 months. Not based on the current status of what's taking place. So what we're doing is we're going to take this in a step-by-step approach, and our goal is to basically, our target is 60% by June of this year. Now, what are we going to do during that time frame? What we're going to be looking at, again, is just basically focusing on our 30-day compliance timeline with highest customer traffic. We've got to stay on top of that. We've got to basically pick and choose what we know that we've got to maintain or what we must maintain versus other areas and systems which we might be able to let go a little bit longer on their cycle. Maintenance teams assigned to specific locations. One of the things that we have is we've talked about this last report. We've got five regions now basically towards we're going to start comparing one region versus another. Within that, we're also going to be start looking at more specialized crafts. Maybe we need to have more electrician-type focus or more electromechanical. We do have a master technician, and we're also looking at utilizing their skill set on how we deploy them to kind of help oversee the various layer and experience of the staff members that we have. The other thing is, again, is just, you know, monthly all-hands or monthly reviews from top to bottom. We just have to continue to look at our data. We have to trend it. We have to make sure that we are making our goals, reaching our goals and objectives. The other thing that I put in here is that developing a plan that will identify increased resource requirement to achieve a target availability goal. This talks it to the top. What is the ideal mark? Everybody, you know, says, well, what does it take to be at 100%? With that, that's a substantial cost, and sometimes it's not always, you know, the most realistic approach. Is the target 90%, you know, or 95%? We have to come back to basically say, based on this age of equipment, provide a step-by-step plan looking out to say, you know, this is the facts. This is how many overhauls we're going to have. This is how many midlifes we're going to have, how many, you know, heavy exchanges we're going to have, and let that feed into the numbers to show you what total sum that we're really left to work with. And that is realistically what we have to deal with at this point in time. And like I say, we'll also be talking about staffing, using other support as well, whatever it takes.
Mr. McKay.
Yeah, a question. I understand how difficult it is to get from 40 to 60%. To our passengers, 60%, of course, still sounds low. And I understand the things you're doing to get these things, I would assume, are designed to get from 40 to 60%. At what point in time will you be able to tell the board what would be necessary, maybe not to get to 100%, but above 60%. Is this a resource thing that we need to fix? There's only so much you can do in managing personnel and dealing with those issues, but I think we need to know, as a board, our passengers are going to want higher than 60%, and we need to know what it's going to take to do that in the long term. When will you be able to tell us what that is?
Well, that's part of the reason why we compressed it into June timeframe, because realistically we know that we're going to be monitoring this, you know, on a monthly basis. I think that, you know, if we're able to basically trend and our assumptions are correct and we're reaching at this 60%, then we're going to be feel comfortable to say, yes, it looks like the plan is implemented, it's working, and now this will be the next level of resources or steps to show y'all what it's going to take to get from the 60 to the 80 and then the 80 and above. Yeah, yeah, probably in the June or July time frame. But this is a hard target, you know, established, which is, it's really for the whole department. Yeah, and, again, I totally agree. You know, 60% is not a benchmark that you would like to post, but it's what we're, where we're at, and this is what we have to get to. It does represent, you know, I guess a 50% increase, but for me it's really mute whenever you're having to walk and work through the system.
Mr. Janko.
Yeah, I'm certainly pleased to see the effort to increase the preventative maintenance. I think that's the key to all this. And looking at your escalator rehab of fiscal 11, I see 14 units under rehab for the year, and I assume that's the goal or that's the plan. Over 6 years, that would amount to about 84 units if they're the same 14 are done or different 14 are done every year for 6 years. Subtracting that from 147 of your item on page 86 that you plan to either rehab or replace means that 63 will be replaced during that period. So that's roughly about, 20-25% of our total assets, right, somewhere in there.
Yeah, we're targeting our low performers first.
Yeah, and then the other question was we had talked about earlier, the rehab, what you're going to do. Are you going to actually do any overhauls this year as well? Remember, we talked about the definition of overhauls versus rehabs. Is there any overhauls in that, or are they combined in this number?
They're all combined.
Yeah, because it looks like they take each about 3 months. I'm just trying to clarify.
I may have misheard you.
Okay.
You had done some arithmetic and came up with the conclusion that 80-some would be replaced.
63 replaced, yeah. 84 rehab.
That is not.
I'm just doing the math.
I know what you're doing is straight-lining the current fiscal year and then turning it into the capital year. I don't believe those are the real numbers.
Okay.
That are presented are real numbers, but not the subtraction ending up with weird.
Let me know. I was just assuming that. Yeah. I'd be curious about that. Again,
this is mostly rehab.
Over time, certainly we want to have a very aggressive preventative maintenance program, complemented by a rehabilitation program and an overhaul program, and obviously ultimately a replacement program. I guess combined program is what I'm looking at and looking for. Thank you.
Yeah. Also, further in our presentation, we talk about some other measures which we feel that will help extend it. It's just physical things that we control. And again, when we talk with other folks, even some of the equipment that we have here, some of this equipment, you know, is 35 plus years, but whenever you look at it, it performs very well. And it gets it back to, you know, how you maintain it and also the designer or the piece of equipment that you're utilizing. So if I could, on the next slide, this on page 85, it kind of talks about some other intermediate measures that pay some dividends.
Yes, Mr. Downing.
Very pleased to see that you will be trying to come up with a goal. I don't think 100% is necessarily the goal, but you'll be telling us what would be the optimum. Can you just explain for me what happens to the remaining percent, the 60% that are not being done now? Do they ever get done? Do they slide into the next cycle?
It'll be a combination where we'll have the others that it makes no sense to go back. And so you just draw a line in the sand, and then basically you just pick up your preventative maintenance right there. Again, we're focusing on the areas where we know we have the highest volume, the highest duty cycle. With those right there, it probably, our discussions with staff, if we check it, you know, for a 30-day cycle, even though it might be at 45, and then 2 weeks later we hit it with a 60-day cycle, it's in our best interest the more that we can touch that. Other units, again, where they're not quite as robust, especially whenever you look at the usage and their exposure, that would be our basic approach at this time.
And that decision is a management-level decision?
A management-level decision. Because, again, as we work on this, as we track these goals, and we look at our percentages on time, that is held accountable by everybody in the elevator and escalator department. because the other component was also very interesting is on our elevator side. You've seen before in our reports and stuff, they're in the 80 or 90%. And so why is there a disparity between the escalators and the elevators, and it's the same department? And those are other things that we're looking at internally as well. Okay, surrounded around parts. Again, some of this is a recap. Identify parts that are available through the original manufacturer. Again, this kind of gets into like almost like our rail cars. Some of these folks that are gone, they're gone. But we know some of the vendors, and you have to start cross-referencing. Some of the vendors no longer even produce it. Then you have to cross-reference over to something else to make sure that it fits. But those are some. That's one effort. Determine alternate manufacturers by, you know, by part numbers. Again, basically looking at relays, can a square D relay work with an ABB relay to make sure that we ensure that we retain the integrity of the system and also the availability of that component, making sure that we don't buy something that's already old that's going to be life cycled out in another year or 2 years. That's the other thing is we know we're going to be around with these things, so let's not self-inflict ourselves with our own engineering efforts and continue to go backwards. Determine parts that require custom fabrication and, you know, create a system of chain of supply. For example, we've got some riser steps that we send out permit or send out for repair. Realistically, it's not cost effective for us. It's basically you're spending 90% on a repaired product versus what you could get brand new. It just does not make any sense. And then the other thing is the service life, and with some of the newer products and everything else, you know, new alloys and everything else, we're getting, you know, better service life. So we're changing that perspective as well. Saves a lot of resources and time. Evaluate part kits for tasks on ordering on a per item basis. Just want to spend just a little bit of time. Since these units are basically more mechanical, a lot of mechanical interfaces, one of the things that's been taking place here is that they replace one component. And I'll, for example, like a drive gear. They'll replace the drive gear, okay? Yes, you fixed it, but the drive gear has a chain or other interfaces. Whenever you replace that one component, the others are already wore out or getting close to the end of their useful life. It will be more cost effective and more efficient on our part to start kitting our repairs. It might take a little bit longer, but at the end of the day, if you know that you've got 3 to 5 mechanical interfaces that are taking place, go ahead and do all of those at the same time instead of waiting for one failure, then it's down, then another failure will occur, and, you know, they accelerate on their failure mode. So that's another area. It's a fundamental shift that this department is going through right now as we assess this. The other thing is it'll also help us on our materials and parts, not having so many onesies and twosies. We really get down very aggressively in addressing these things and increases our standards. In-house reverse engineering capability. I've noted this before, looking at some really sound mechanical engineers. Again, you know, this equipment is it is unique. You don't have a lot of elevator escalator engineers out there, but there are some good folks with very sound mechanical skills that can really help you a lot. Okay, next slide, please. This fiscal year, you know, we're going to rehab or replace 16 units. Most of them are on the red line. We do have, you know, an appendix and stuff in here to kind of give you an overview of what's taking place. We do footnote that, you know, this is a multi-year capital program, replacement of over 147 units over the next 6 years. And, again, this was just kind of a footnote is that, you know, trying to increase this 40 to 60 is 50%, but it's definitely by no means where we really need to end up at. But it's also a way for us to talk with our staff and to kind of lay out the outline that, you know, there's a lot of good things that they can achieve, but we've just got to focus on it. Okay, and with the customer outreach, I'll let Lynn.
Lynn Bowersox from the Customer Service Communications and Marketing Department. Information that Dave presented in terms of all of the detail about our escalator program for our customers, as you know, really boils down to one thing. When is my escalator going to be fixed? And so our intention is to try to answer that very simple question by doing a better job through breadth and depth outreach around the escalator program with very specific information by station, by line, about the escalators. So as people know, we've started on Foggy Bottom. We're starting to get the word out about DuPont Circle, which will begin in May. We have, over the course of this summer through August, 14 additional escalator units, which are listed on the appendix, which will be taken out of service for repair and rehabilitation. And then over the course of the six-year period, we have 147 additional units. So what you see in this tactics list here is simply the channels through which we'll be communicating that information to our customers, using our website, using our escalator page, which is part of Vital Signs, also using our intranet so our employees know about it, and through our paper channels so our employees without internet access also have the escalator information so that they can answer questions to our customers. We're going to send information on a per escalator basis out via our email alert system for subscribers through our Twitter updates, which we provide on a regular basis. We're going to apply signage in the stations on our fare gates, and even using the plywood boards that surround the escalators while they're out of service to give customers information regarding the ongoing escalator program. We also obviously partner with the media considerably and depend on them to help us communicate and re-communicate that information to our customers, and this will be no exception. So as we go along through the program, we'll be publishing information regarding milestones as we take escalators out, as we get to, you know, key points in the redevelopment of escalators, and as we put them back into service, all with an expectation of trying to help customers estimate when my escalator is going to go out of service, when it's going to come back into service, so that I can plan my travel accordingly. Are there any questions?
Ms. Hutchins?
Thank you, and I really wanted to hear that customer outreach part, because I think you're right. Our customers probably say, when will my escalator be fixed? But they'll probably say, is my escalator working? I raise that because I think what we've talked about on the repair side and the rehabilitating the system is very critical. But the customer doesn't know the difference when an escalator isn't moving. And I'll give an example. Sitting at the station waiting, I'm noticing that an escalator is in the walk mode. And many people walked up, and they continue to walk up. And one person brought the station manager back, and guess what? They turned it on, and it was working. And to me, that means something is missing in the operational side of the station and that work that the station manager or someone must do. And the other example is an escalator stops and you say, oh, and you just assume it stopped and you keep going and the whatever. I think this is important. This is critical. This is really the safety part of making sure that it works correctly. But the view of the customer is that if the escalator isn't working, it's a problem. But they have no idea about all of the other things that you're doing. So it's so important that I think we have something to ensure that that operational role of keeping the station working for the customer is included. And I don't know what to offer you, but given those few experiences, it makes me wonder, when we signage or we communicate, is there something else we can let customers understand? I know we have to take them in and out to keep operational flow. But to believe that you're walking because you're helping the flow and really you're just walking because somebody forgot to monitor the escalator is a really concern, I think.
Kathy?
It's a very good idea to put this information up on the web page, but sometimes things on the web page aren't necessarily easy for someone to get to. And so if I am trying to find out, I have a trip from station X to station Y, and I want to know if there's escalator problems at either of those two locations. How many, and I go to the website to try to find that out, how complicated or how many clicks does it take me to get from the main page of the web to that information?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to how many clicks, but what we do have is rolling service information that's generally two or three clicks away if there's an issue. So depends on the level of issue that you might encounter with an escalator, obviously. A routine escalator that's out of service for maintenance won't come up on that sort of top-of-mind part of the web. You have to dig a little deeper. But if you like, I can get back to you with some specific information. We can review it to make sure that we're making it as user-friendly as possible with as few clicks, particularly from a mobile device, as possible.
That I think that would be very helpful, because if we don't make it very accessible to people, they're not going to use it.
Thank you.
Ms. Hines?
Ms. Bowersox, it would seem to me that that a simple solution for this would be that when I go to the trip planner and I say I'm going from Clarendon to Metro Center, that once I put that trip in, what would pop up are the escalator and elevator outages and maybe even single, I don't know what other kind of ordinary stuff we keep, but if somehow that could all be brought to that place, then I would know, even if I'm a regular rider, that if I put that in, it's going to tell me what my issues might be at the place I get on and the place I think I'm going to get off.
Excellent suggestion.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
One other question, backing up to the first part. Last month you gave us a census of the escalators by manufacturer, but it didn't tell us which are the four that are out of business. That would be helpful to have.
We can follow up and note those.
Any other questions on the issue? I think one observation, listening to people talk about the system right now, there may be an assumption that there is a rehab and maintenance program going on. A concern is the operational safety of the existing escalators before we get to them. The issue about a section falling, acceleration, stops, and how we reassure the customer that in this environment where we know we are behind and we can't get out, how do we target escalators that are potentially vulnerable? Where's the highest risk? Where's our lessons learned about previous incidents and what we're doing in that context? To be able to tell them that we're proactive about that unanticipated escalator experience and what we're doing about it, I think is an important part of our story. I think it needs some thought, and it needs some visible program content to be able to address that.
Duly noted. We can look at possibly working with Lynn and them on some follow-up to try to get more information out on the website. I know the one thing that we did on the elevator escalator website several months ago was just start cleaning up some of the information that had been there for 10 years or however long that it's been in existence, so we could duly note some of the findings or some of the efforts. And I do would like to conclude that the preventative maintenance effort, making sure that we're checking this equipment, maybe some of the additional reviews that we're going to be undertaking in campaigns and stuff, and maybe explaining those a little bit more on some of the items that y'all have already requested with us, putting out there as well would help, you know, tell the story as well of the efforts that are being undertaken to sustain these systems.
Good. Any other comments or questions on this agenda item? Hearing none, let's quickly go, unfortunately, to the operational access per hour, and let me explain how this got to be on the agenda. When this first came before the board, it was as a budget suggestion about a cost savings reduction, about the potential elimination of the locally known as Night Owl service, and I objected at that time because it is not a budget issue as far as I'm concerned. It is a issue that deals with a problem that we have not been completely dealing with, I don't believe, and that is the availability of rail system access to accommodate the programmed capital investment in the rail system over the next 3 years. I ask Rich to take a look at what the impacts of that service are and the requirements of the rail capital program. The full elements aren't here about the number of options that could or should be on the table. I asked Rich earlier if it would be possible to program the next 18 to 24 months worth of rail capital that is in the pipeline, including some of the delays we're now experiencing with the current year capital program, make a best guess estimate of what track time is required to accommodate that construction schedule, to look at what actual available tools under the current status are available for creating that track time going forward, and what the deficit is. I don't believe we are meeting the needs of our customers if we are accidentally backing into major strategies that either include delaying because we can't get enough track time going forward, delaying or postponing the rail investment, or that we subject them to an ad hoc, not well thought out strategic approach to how we create the track time to accommodate this $1 billion a year capital program for the next 3 years. There are options that should be considered. One of the options is what we're doing with the Silver Line work, and that is a complete closure of a line for a period of time to accommodate construction. And if it is an issue that the board needs to grapple with about whether or not it's in the customer's best interest long term to take a line out of service, then we should try to address that. If it means changing part of the hours of service, we should address that, including a later opening in the morning. If all of those options together are on the table against the required track availability time for this program, I think the customers would feel much better that we're trying to struggle with both their best interest and the needs of the rail reconstruction program. I cannot honestly say that that is on the table right now, and we're doing this 6 months at a time in a very ad hoc fashion about what we need to have in terms of rail availability. And I, for one, don't think that's a good policy for our customers. We have on the agenda for the June meeting a rail interruption report, which is a focus on the next 6 months. I asked the general manager if he would, working with staff, take a look, and it's not going to be perfect, but take a look at the requirements for trackage, for track time, for the construction program for the next 24 months, make an estimate about what is actually available for track time for that construction program, give us a potential deficit, and give us what our options are to be able to make those decisions to accommodate this. There is nothing more important than doing this credibly for our riders. So I don't want to have you start to get into this in terms of just the night owl service. It is a much broader issue, and I ask that it come back to the committee in June with that context.
Well, as we discussed earlier, and I agree,
we've been moving along to develop the capability to do just that kind of planning. And in talking to Dave, I think we're at that point where we can do that. So I think the June timeframe would be a good time frame to come back and present that over the next couple of years, what we're seeing in the possible alternatives as best we can. I think we're in a better position to do that than we were several months ago.
Yes, absolutely. So I think if we ultimately we have to push parts of the construction program into out years, we destroy our credibility with our funders mm-hmm. and risk some of our funding lapsing. Mm-hmm. And that's the only pressure valve that we've got right now is to simply defer it because we don't have enough time on the system to be able to do the work.
I agree with Mr. Down. I think it's logical, rational, forward-looking. In the analysis, I think it would also be helpful for each option to indicate the degree of passenger disruption that would occur.
Mr. McKay? I really appreciate Mr. Down's explanation. I think it's right on target. And in fact, I had asked specifically, I do appreciate the information in here from staff on page 84. Because that was a specific question that I had, is so that I could get a better understanding from a labor standpoint how much you can get done with these different tiered hours. And I think that's a start down the process that was just outlined of information that we need. I guess the only question that I have, and I concur about this being a operations issue. However, it first came up this year in the context of the budget. And I'm wanting to understand the report that's coming in June and how that tracks with our schedule to adopt the budget, because we are going to be asked to adopt a budget, and this is going to be a question, it remains a question, in the context of the budget. And so I don't want to wait until June to get a lot of the answers to the questions Mr. Down raised, because those are questions that at least some of them I'd like to have answered before we have to consider this in the context of the budget. So help me understand how the timeline between that information relates to when we would have to act on the budget.
Well, we'll be discussing the budget, I guess, in the next committee meeting. The time frames are going to come together at that point. The problem will be is we'll be presenting the options at the time you want to adopt the budget. So there will not be the time frame to have that full discussion of the options. It's going to be probably fairly complicated, a lot of balancing of different factors. So that is a difficult point. I just would be hesitant to promise to you that we could do something a lot earlier in terms of the two-year time frame, because I want to get it right. The budget impact is in the $3.5 million range, if I recall correctly. So not sure how to solve that little issue.
I think it's something we have to be aware of. I've been asked the question repeatedly about the late night service from folks, and you know, my answer has been simple to date, which is when you have the budget challenge that we have, everything should be on the table. But everything before this board should act ought to be, you know, explained in a pretty clear, concise way so that we know the cost and benefit analysis of some of these things. And I think Mr. Down's point is dead on, is that this is, you know, this becomes an issue of track time for me. Secondarily, there's a budget question, but for me, the first question is, are we giving our staff the right amount of time to go out there and rebuild this system and protect their safety? And that's the question that Mr. Downs is asking, but I also know that it's looming in the context of the budget, and we're going to need a little bit more guidance than is what is found in this item to help the full board make a responsible decision on that issue. And I see these two things coming to a head on two different timelines. We need to reconcile that some way. We know now that that's going to happen. To the extent we can get additional information about some of the questions that Mr. Downs raised before we have to act on the budget, I think is going to be important to this board.
Ms. Hudgens.
Mr. Down, I thank you, because I will tell you the conversations that I've been hearing with customers are really the conversations you've just had. That is, it's a quick answer to say no, because we talked about it as service, but really when we talk about it in the context of the state of the repair and what we have to do, they're willing to talk about options. And I think this does lack that. And I think the question is, do we move forward? And that may be a delayed decision for another hour in terms of the budget question. But I think that it's not a budget question. It's a safety question. And so the opportunity to try and help understand what we can deliver in terms of what we commit to safety, and then what are the sacrifices we might ask our customers to make. Mr. Saul's kind of mentioned a number, but that number may be different depending upon what options we hear and what we're willing to, what our customers are willing to bear. But I think more than anything else, I want to hear the message that I will give my customers for what this sacrifice will mean. That is the understanding that there is going to be improved safety in this system for them, which we've articulated, and the level of sacrifice they need to make. I think that bottom line of the timing is very important for us, even if it has to be a budget with some temporary shift in what our commitment might be.
Well, we still have a budget issue open, which was raised by the staff, and that is the yellow, green, and red line service reduction recommendations that will have to be dealt with as part of the budget process as well. The stakes are so high about this, though, accommodating the capital budget, that I'm very reluctant to see it as a strictly in a budget light. I think at some point in the system, somebody has to make sacrifices to make way for this construction program over the next 3 years. Our job, I think, is to provide guidance about who sacrifices when, for what kind of outcome, and then to be accountable for those decisions. And we're not doing that. We're doing it in a very ad hoc way, and I think the only way to make this is this kind of decision is to have the right data about the requirements, the right data about the current availability, and make some tough choices about where the room gets made and who pays, because at some point we're going to have to reduce some of the system for a temporary period of time to make way for the reconstruction. And we can't put a gloss on it, and we can't make the decision as just about $3 million. It's much, much greater than that.
Mr. Downs?
I'm sorry, Mr. Wells?
Yeah, I agree with you. I believe that the economic impact on the city in terms of lost revenue and the businesses is much greater than the $3 million saved by Metro, so that the city would have to certainly, the customers are not just the riders, obviously it's the businesses and the regions that are served in order to do business. And as we've built businesses around the transit system and the expectation of having a transit system, it's not just a commuter system anymore. So that type of analysis, I think, will be helpful to the district of how much the region, but the district in particular, of how much money it'll cost the district beyond the savings of the $3 million. Then the other parts, of course, is to be sure we're not looking at a shotgun approach, that we're looking at the sophistication of a system to be able to do things in sections, and a communication approach. Also, what's best practices among other cities? We're now the second largest city rail system in the country, and to understand how they're able to manage and what's best practice to do the repairs. I think that there will always be an issue of how much the rail is in operation and to be able to do just our maintenance. And obviously the less that it's in operation, the easier it is to do the maintenance and repairs, and that will always be a trade-off. And there will always be a tension between the engineers and the other folks in the communities that have come to depend on our rail system. in a lot of different ways. So the analysis hopefully will look at the shot, you know, the shotgun approach to shut the whole thing down after midnight every day, and then also the ability to look at to do this a little bit more finely. And then also just to restore the confidence that so many of our maintenance programs are behind schedule, and the ability to actually put a date out there and say, oh, we would be able to get this done in this period of time. There's not a lot of confidence that we can, because so many of the capital projects are behind schedule from the dates that have been projected. So that does need to be part of the analysis. Thank you, Mr. Downs.
I'd also like to echo everybody's comments about this being a very deliberate process in terms of looking at our capital program and how we phase it. In Chicago, where I came from, we had a similar instance where we actually shut down the line for 2 years in order to rebuild it. I don't think that sort of action is necessary in this case, but I would say there's a spectrum of choices that the board has to make in order to bring the system up to a good state of repair. In Chicago, we made a very difficult decision to shut down an entire rail line for 2 years in order to bring that line up to, you know, a reasonable state of repair. Again, I don't think that's necessarily the case here, but I also think that's a fundamental decision that the board as an entity needs to make. I also would have to say that when we look at these choices, we also should look at alternative bus service in a reasonable option. I think I see a map here just showing weeknight service. I think in order to compare apples to apples, I think we need to ask the staff to actually put together a service plan that would be similar or provide coverage so our customers will, you know, have access to service, whether it's bus or rail. I think from the agency standpoint, we should consider putting out a service that meets the need of our customers, no matter if we close the rail at night. And for what length of time. So I think that's something else I would like to see in the analysis. But I think it is a very difficult decision, but I think it is one that we don't take lightly, but we need to look at very deliberately.
Ms. Hodge.
I just want to emphasize a point that I was trying to make earlier and may not have, but and that is that I don't think we're walking away from this issue. But what we really are trying to do, and I think use the best practice, we have done a good job on some major repairs by taking the system out in certain places at that. And so we, at least what I hear from customers, they have a confidence when you tell them that it's going to be the holiday weekend and that they'll have their system back. We've done that. And so we have that to build upon. But I would hope that we bring those businesses to the table, because the options to them are very important, and that we can really understand what they're willing to do and what the impact then can be to them. After all, they're getting an improved system as well, and their customers are getting an improved system. So I think I want to look at it as a positive opportunity to look at some really thoughtful options rather than that it's just going to be an onerous experience for people, and that shouldn't be our focus.
Just one other point. I think at a previous meeting, we talked about our inability or lack of ability to communicate the real benefits of this capital improvements program. And really, when we went through this discussion in Chicago, it was really, what are you getting in return for this inconvenience? And I think, you know, we've talked about, you know, perhaps the staff coming back to us with that, with a campaign to discuss those benefits. But I think that's something that we might want to talk about when this comes back to us in June, is really, at the end of the day, you know, you're getting, what does better service reliability mean? What does this really mean in terms of safety? You know, and I think that's the way we need to to discuss this with our customers, and I don't really see that being, you know, communicated in a very clear way right now. So I think that's a big piece of this decision, is kind of what are people getting at the end of the day in real terms.
I do want to echo what Ms. Hudgens says about, I think that people have been watching these weekend closures and feeling very comfortable with the level of information and with their understanding about what's happening, why it's happening, and that service is coming back. And so I think it has put us in a place to have a better conversation with customers about things which might be more disruptive than a 3 or 4 day long weekend. The other thing I would like to make sure that comes back to us when this comes back, particularly around some of the marginal hours, is I think it would be useful for the board to understand better which stations are actually being used at which levels, because that does influence costs in some ways, decisions to keep everything open versus keeping key places open. And I would just also remark, to the extent that that economic analysis of business activity flows into this, the orange line and the blue line in Arlington have the same characteristics as much of downtown D.C., you know, the hot spots in D.C. So I would request that if we're going to look at that issue, that we look at those, at the other places. I've been riding late night now on the orange line, and I am stunned at how full the trains are coming into Arlington. You know, from 10 o'clock to midnight, they're full of people. So I just think if we're going to move that route and make sure and put that as a factor, let's make sure that we do that in a way that's comprehensive.
Chairman, okay. I just want to respond to that issue because I think it's a good one. I guess the question is, where does the analysis responsibility lie? My belief is the jurisdictions have a much better handle on that than this agency does or should. You know, we're here for the benefit of our passengers. Many of them live in different jurisdictions, but the jurisdictions who see themselves having an enormous vested interest in this ought to be able to come up with those figures themselves and not rely on WMATA staff to make judgment calls that may be subjective about that feature. And I guess I would add that we're asking the staff for a lot of important information. We're hearing from some of our customers. We represent jurisdictions that could be impacted by this, and I think we need to also come to the table with ideas from our jurisdictions as to how we can handle this impact. And it strikes me that if you were to cut back service in Arlington County, in the district that are impacted heavily by late night services, what are the business communities and organizations in those areas going to do? What is the Chamber of Commerce thinking? Is there a way to buy down taxi cab fares or provide other jurisdictional service during a period of time when we might have to look at doing this? And so if we ever go down this path, it's going to have to be a collaborative one that involves the jurisdictions who have impacts, the business community in those jurisdictions, and others to try to solve this problem. I don't see it as being one that solely Metro is going to be able to come up with all the answers and solutions to. And I think we need to be thinking in our own jurisdictions as to how we might be able to deal with this situation. At the same time, Metro is looking at the various questions we've asked today.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you. I'd like to associate myself with the comments of my council colleague, Mr. Wells, but also at some community meetings where I've been, and certainly not suggesting that you and I have had this conversation about a 24-hour system. Some folks would like, we're moving in the wrong direction. I understand the realities, why that may be unlikely. But there are a lot of folks that would like to see a 24-hour system. And so from our standpoint, it's not just the businesses as well as also the employees. Because even if the bars and restaurants and people stop patronizing some of these restaurants in particular places, an hour or two after that, then the employees have to get home. So we have issues besides just the customers. There are also employee issues. So I just want to put that on the record, but I wanted to associate myself with Mr. Wells. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just for clarity, and this discussion is very helpful, what I think we can do and what I intended to do with the June-July time frame is to present from a Metro viewpoint the operational slash maintenance slash capital options, if you will. Jeff's comments were very helpful. I don't think we could be in a position to do an economic impact analysis in that time frame. That then can serve as a starting point for the discussions I've just mentioned, if that's okay with the board.
I think that's fine. Just an order of magnitude comment. If you look at the proposed 12, 13, 14 capital budgets, particularly in rail, and you look at the anticipated obligation rates and the ability to get the work in the ground. At its peak, in probably 2 years, you will see twice as much work as we're experiencing now. And if everybody thinks that this every week drill about service interruptions, bridges, outages, long weekend, and imagine twice this volume in the next 24 months or 36 months, and trying to fit that into the available window is going to be a very difficult challenge. And I think that's where we have to work with staff about making sure that this is all public and well planned.
We will tackle it. I just want to also mention that significant parts of the capital program are equipment procurements also. So, and 7,000 series will make a lot of payments there, which, thank God, will not affect the tracks.
And just not to get into the numbers here, but keeping in mind that a larger block of time is far more productive than a small slice of time, and we should be looking at that.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on this issue? Any other issues before the committee? Hearing none, I will declare the committee meeting adjourned.